intrigue, power, scandal. Hollywood loves these themes, and what better backdrop than our nation's capital? It's Politics Day on River to River from IPR News. I'm Emily Woodbury, in for Ben Kiefer. Today on the show, a look at television's portrayal of Washington, D.C. We'll examine how we went from this NBC classic,
"He shall, from time to time, give to the Congress information of the State of the Union and recommend to their consideration such measures as he shall judge necessary and expedient,"
to this darker view of D.C.
"One heartbeat away from the presidency, not a single vote cast in my name. Democracy is so overrated."
What political TV show do you watch, and what do you take away from it? Join our discussion after this news from NPR. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Emily Woodbury, in for Ben Kiefer. It's Politics Day today, and this hour we'll take a look at how Washington politics is portrayed on television. Joining me for the discussion are political scientists Rachel Caulfield, associate professor at Drake University. Hi, Rachel.
Hi there.
Chris Larimer, associate professor at the University of Northern Iowa. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Emily.
And David Anderson, assistant professor at Iowa State University. Hello, David.
Hi, Emily.
And we want to hear from all the political junkies this hour and television fans. Maybe you just watched the season finale of Veep, House of Cards. Maybe you enjoy shows like Scandal or Homeland. And of course, there's The West Wing. What political TV show do you watch, and what do you take away from it? Have you learned anything about the political process from watching one of these shows? Give us a call, 1-866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk, message us on Facebook, or email us at rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. And just before we start off the conversation, there might be a few spoiler alerts during the show today. So if you're nervous about one of those, as soon as you hear maybe, oh, this last episode on Veep, maybe you want to turn your radio down. Or maybe you'll want to know, for the curious folks out there. Let's start off the hour by listening to clips from NBC's The West Wing from the early 2000s and House of Cards, recently released by Netflix. Two very different shows. You can hear it in the theme music, the voice of the main characters. You have the beloved President Jed Bartlett in West Wing and Frank Underwood in House of Cards, who is more of an anti-hero, almost, I would say, a villain at times. This first clip is from President Jeb Bartlett, played by Martin Sheen, talking with the member of his cabinet picked to stay behind in case of an attack during the State of the Union address.
Roger.
Good evening, Mr. President.
Roger, I'm sorry you drew the short straw on this. No, we'll miss you tonight. Next year, it'll be the Surgeon General, I promise. Meanwhile, you can watch on TV in my study.
Thank you, sir. I brought you a gift.
Oh, thank you.
I know of your love of all things ancient, and I came across this.
What is it?
Someone took the time to translate our Constitution into Latin. I think it was a high school project, actually, and it got published.
Oh, this is magnificent.
I highlighted what I thought was an appropriate passage from the executive powers section. Can you translate?
"He shall, from time to time, give to the Congress information of the State of the Union and recommend to their consideration such measures as he shall judge necessary and expedient."
Sounds right up your alley, sir.
Thanks, Roger.
Knock him dead, sir.
Oh, Roger. If anything happened, you know what to do, right?
I honestly hadn't thought about it, sir.
First thing always is national security. Get your commanders together. Appoint joint chiefs, appoint a chairman, take us to DEFCON 4. Have the governor send emergency delegates to Washington. The assistant attorney general is going to be the acting agent. If he tells you he wants to bring out the National Guard, do what he tells you. You got a best friend?
Yes, sir.
Is he smarter than you?
Yes, sir.
Would you trust him with your life?
Yes, sir.
That's your chief of staff.
And as a comparison, here's a short clip from House of Cards.
"And that I will well and faithfully discharge the duties of the office on which I'm about to enter."
So help me God.
So help me God. "One heartbeat away from the presidency, not a single vote cast in my name. Democracy is so overrated.
How can we explain the difference between these two shows? Rachel, let's start off with you. You know, what was happening in politics at the time West Wing aired?
Well, certainly, I like to think of The West Wing as Aaron Sorkin's love letter to Bill Clinton. This was a time when there was a good deal of, I think, positivity about what government could do. You had a young president in office. You had a lot of excitement around that presidency. And when you kind of compare to where we are today, we again have a young president in office and we had a lot of idealism, but we also have a Congress that's deadlocked and we have a good deal more cynicism among the American public about whether or not government can actually work. And so over time, I think we've become, as a country, we've become more cynical about the people in power, what their motives are, and their capability to actually get anything done.
Dave, Chris, do you have anything to add about, you know, the political climate of House of Cards and then West Wing?
Well, I would agree with Rachel. I think, you know, the West Wing, if you transition from the West Wing to House of Cards, it tracks pretty nicely with what we've seen as far as declines in public opinion really across the board, as Rachel alluded to, whether you're talking about sort of approval of Congress, confidence in the governmental institutions, trust in government, or just simply the notion that elected officials are crooked. I think all those things have become more negative, and a lot of it's related to this notion that elected officials are out of touch, that they're corrupt, that the political system is not open, that even if it would be open, it's all about money, and the average citizen simply does not have enough money to compete with bigger interests. And I think that's where, you know, that's kind of going from West Wing all the way to House of Cards, and I think that's the perception that the House of Cards series is playing on at the moment.
And Dave, do you want to add anything? And I might add a question too, that, you know, do these shows have the potential to shape public perception?
Oh, I think they absolutely do have that potential. I think Chris and Rachel are completely right that the West Wing was just this great idyllic drama about what we wish our leaders were like. And unfortunately, House of Cards is now kind of showing what everybody fears our leaders are like. And I'm afraid that is going to drive public opinion. These are very popular shows about politics, and this is really how people, I think, understand the political process.
How accurately do these shows depict what's really going on in Washington?
I would say West Wing very accurately showed the process. West Wing was very good about showing the balance between executive power and congressional power and how things were done. But again, it showed a very idyllic representation about the people in power. House of Cards, I don't think is very realistic in many ways at all. It is House of Cards was based on a British TV series that explained how Parliament worked. And they had to do some big changes to make it work in an American context. And unfortunately, to do that, I think they kind of erased a lot of the actual political context. So you don't really get a good view of how Congress works or how the executive branch works, and certainly not how those two branches work together. And then you throw in some pretty nasty political characters to add to it.
Mm-hmm. And Dave, if I'm right, you've had some trouble with your students believing House of Cards was an accurate portrayal of Washington. Do you have any specific examples of what they got wrong?
Well, let's see. Yes, I did have to spend nearly an entire lecture once explaining how Congress really works and how the House whip cannot very well manufacture himself into the vice presidency.
Really? That doesn't happen every day?
I guess the two big things that stand out to me is, one, in House of Cards, once Frank becomes vice president, he's portrayed as a very powerful vice president, as if the president always involves the vice president in every important meeting, as if he consults with the vice president. And the reality is, I don't think we've had very many powerful vice presidents in history. The one glaring exception may be Dick Cheney under the Bush presidency. But otherwise, vice presidents generally are there for the election, and then they're sent out to kind of keep up diplomatic relations. They're not very powerful. Mm-hmm. And beyond that, I think the other big error is the big scandal, or one of the big scandals in House of Cards, is the flow of money into Washington. And there's a big controversy about a $25 million contribution, which, when you think about a typical election cycle, which we're now spending, I think, $2 billion, $25 million really doesn't raise too many eyebrows. If anything, I think House of Cards really downplays the role of money. They don't get a good sense of how much money is at stake.
And I think that's actually a quote from House of Cards, that the main character values power over wealth.
Yes.
It's all about power. Mm-hmm. And I think it's interesting, too. We'll talk about Veep in a little bit. But in Veep, the vice president has, she seems to have no power whatsoever.
And I think that's more accurate.
Yes.
And is probably a very accurate portrayal of how frustrating that is as a vice president, to be technically a heartbeat away from the presidency and yet have no actual power.
So I'll put this question to all of you. What does it say about how society, you know, takes these programs if even political science students have misconceptions about them?
Well, I think, you know, we have to remember that all of our media is a commercial venture. And so, you know, as a character-driven, scripted drama, they can do drama very well, and they can bring people into the halls of power, some conception of the halls of power. And for those people who are on the outside looking in and thinking, gosh, someday I'd like to do that. So even our political science students who dream of becoming a part of the Washington crowd, I think they see it and they're trying to take away points that would allow them to understand what that role looks like. For the average American who feels disconnected from this, I think it's, you know, it reinforces their worst fears about who these people are and what their motivations are.
And Rachel,
go ahead. I think one of the draws of House of Cards is that it plays on, as Rachel said, sort of a lot of our deeply held suspicions about people in government, but it's the part of the governmental process that people really don't get to observe, sort of the behind-the-scenes dealings, you know, the behind-the-scenes conversations, which unless you're, you know, Bob Woodward, you do not have access to those type of conversations. And so I think people are drawn to it because it sort of plays on all of our fears. And nobody really has any sense of what goes on behind the scenes.
And Rachel, you've had some classroom discussions about these shows, correct?
I've had a lot of classroom discussions. I've been teaching a first-year seminar called American Politics on Screen, where we actually consider exactly these questions. And I find it interesting. I think for the most part, you know, most of our students obviously realize that there's some license that's been taken by the creators of these shows. But at the same time, it's amazing to me how quickly even our political science students are to really grab onto these shows and say, you know, this is the new West Wing. The House of Cards is the new West Wing. And I actually couldn't disagree more. I don't think it is at all. It's a very different show and it portrays a very different side of politics. And it conveys a different sense of who we are, not only in Washington, but I think as a political community. Mm-hmm.
I'd be curious to hear Dave and Rachel's take on whether or not these shows have sort of permeated down to all levels of government. That is, do their students think that state politics operates this way? Do city council members operate the way that their elected officials are portrayed in House of Cards?
Well, I can answer that. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, my dismal answer is that I don't think many of my students are very aware of state and local
yeah.
politics.
Well, yeah, beyond that. But yeah.
And I'm very sympathetic to my students kind of buying into what they see in House of Cards, because it's very difficult to learn about the political process in our country. Unless you are in a college-level course on political science, our high schools don't offer many courses that really explain the political process. So our students and all of the public are left with either watching TV or reading the newspaper. And the newspaper doesn't do a very good job of explaining process. And TV, as Rachel has said, it's a commercial venture. They have to sell entertainment and not really education. And increasingly, I think that's kind of the way they've gone.
So what's the risk of getting it wrong for having these misperceptions about what's going on, or even, you know, latching on to our biggest fears about what's going on in Washington or even at a state level?
I think the biggest danger is just that if the entire public starts believing that our politicians are all like Frank Underwood and are nefarious and evil and power hungry, it kind of turns us off from the process. And democracy requires that people are involved with the process. And I think it also makes people more susceptible to kind of vote for people who claim they're going to clean up the system without really listening to what their alternatives are.
All right. Well, we have to take a break. We'll be back in just a few minutes with more of River to River. This hour, we're talking about Washington politics and how they're portrayed on television. It's Politics Day. Joining me for the discussion, Rachel Caulfield of Drake University, Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa, and Dave Anderson of Iowa State University. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Emily Woodbury in for Ben Kiefer. Today, it's Politics Day, and this hour we're taking a look at how Washington politics is portrayed on television. Joining me for the discussion are political experts Rachel Caulfield at Drake University, Chris Larimer from the University of Northern Iowa, and Dave Anderson at Iowa State University. And in the first half of the program, we talked a lot about, you know, what we can and can't learn about these shows and some of the things they get wrong, some of the things they get right. And we want to hear from you. What political TV show do you watch and what do you take away from it? You can give us a call at 1-866-780-9100, tweet us at IPR Talk, message us on Facebook, or email us at rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. We've heard from Joy on Facebook, "The West Wing has my vote for best political drama. Smart, funny, hopeful, brilliant." And a Facebook post from Caitlin who says, "Scandal was way better in season one. It's getting over the top now." They do have the occasional epic speech, though. "House of Cards just makes you love to hate D.C., and you spend time wondering if your state senator is doing drugs or destroying a valuable movement." "But West Wing will forever be my favorite D.C. show." And I want to talk a little bit about West Wing because, you know, in talking about this subject, a lot of people say, you know, West Wing was the show that actually, you know, talked about policy. And one of the issues brought up on West Wing more than a decade ago was gays and lesbians serving openly in the military. In this next clip, White House aide Sam, played by Rob Lowe, is discussing a report with members of a congressional committee and representatives from the military. The report shows that confessions by gay and lesbian service members of their sexual orientation were coerced, and servicemen and women discharged because of the statements.
"We know the report.
We know the report. A lot of those cases you're talking about of the gays being discharged came from voluntary statements.
And a lot of these are not voluntary statements, not by any definition given by any civilian court in this country. It is not a voluntary statement when it's given to a psychotherapist, as in the case of former Marine Corporal David Blessing. It is not a voluntary statement when it's made in a personal diary, as in the case of former West Point cadet Nicole Garrison. It is not when it's made after being asked, as in the case of Master Chief Petty Officer Diane Kelly. And it is not when it is coerced out of a service member through fear, through intimidation, through death threats, and threats of criminal prosecution, as in the case of former Air Force Major Bob Kittis, former Marine Gunnery Sergeant Kevin Keyes, and four sailors aboard the USS Essex."
"Sam, you take care of your guys, we'll take care of ours."
"You're not taking care of your guys, Major. Your guys are out looking for jobs."
"Those weren't our guys."
"Oh, my God."
"Attention."
"Good afternoon, Sam."
"Mr. Chairman."
"Congressman."
"How do you do, Admiral?"
"Good to see you again, kid. We haven't met."
"Mike Satchel."
"From Oregon."
"Yes, sir."
"Percy Fitzwallace."
"It's an honor to meet you, Admiral."
"I imagine it would be, yes."
"Major Tate, Major Thompson, this is Chairman Fitzwallace."
"They're not going to speak until I speak to them, Sam. They're pretty well trained. Stand easy, fellas. This Danish for anybody?"
"Oh, yes, sir."
"Thank you. We're discussing gays in the military, huh?"
"Yes, sir."
"What do you think?" "I said, what do you think?"
"Sir, we're here to help the White House form a policy."
"I know. I'm asking you what you think."
"Sir, we're not prejudiced toward homosexuals."
"You just don't want to see them serving in the armed forces."
"No, sir, I don't."
"Because they pose a threat to unit discipline and cohesion."
"Yes, sir."
"That's what I think, too. I also think the military wasn't designed to be an instrument of social change."
"Yes, sir."
"Problem with that is, that's what they were saying about me 50 years ago. Blacks shouldn't serve with whites. It would disrupt the unit. You know what? It did disrupt the unit. The unit got over it. The unit changed. I'm an admiral in the U.S. Navy and chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Beat that with a stick. We'll see you, Ken."
As we mentioned, this was a show that aired more than a decade ago, but it's an issue that's seen tremendous change in just the last few years. Do you guys think this is an example of popular culture and TV driving change, or is popular culture picking up on a change already happening in politics?
I would say it's probably a little bit of both. They kind of go hand in hand, that TV is willing to air ideas and concepts that are kind of bubbling up through society, and segments of society encounter these ideas through television. So I think they work together.
I think that's probably true. I think if you rewatch The West Wing, it's astounding how many issues are brought up. And the policy discussions that were happening on The West Wing among the characters are, in many cases, the same policy discussions that we're having today. And we've advanced, perhaps, in the way our political culture perceives those issues or speaks about those issues. But I think going back to The West Wing, and I'll admit, I go back to The West Wing after I finish any episode of The House of Cards. it's my antidote to House of Cards. But if you go back and watch some of these older episodes, I think there's no doubt that it is both a reflection of the conversation that we were having then, but it was also pushing the envelope and pushing a certain way of speaking about some of these issues, whether it's immigration or gays and lesbians in the military or education reform. You can go pretty much across the board and you'll find virtually all of those policy issues that are still on the political agenda today.
Do you think Washington's especially a good backdrop for, you know, making these sort of political points and statements? Or do other kinds of shows do it better? Maybe shows that aren't set in Washington, D.C. and aren't focused on the scandal and, you know, the intrigue?
I think Washington is probably as good as it's going to get, just simply because when people think of government, they think of Washington, D.C. They think of the presidency. And I wonder also, and I don't really have any data to support this, but I know Dave and Rachel and like them both, so I think they'll go easy on me on this. But, you know, one of the frustrations that the public generally has about government is about the process, that it is a slow process, that it's very deliberative, that there's a lot of compromise, that things don't get done quickly. And I wonder if that's one thing that maybe the House of Cards at least somewhat gets right, that there's a lot of bickering, that there's a lot of things that go on behind the scenes, whereas in The West Wing, it was almost a false sense of hope that if you engage in the political process, you can accomplish things. And maybe it's because I've been watching House of Cards too much lately and not enough West Wing.
Trust me, it's a good antidote.
Right. But I wonder if it at least helps with that perception, that it really drives home the point that, look, this is a very slow process and it was designed to be slow. A number of political scientists several years ago started a movement to really to put that into civics classes in high schools, that, look, this is a slow process. You don't always get done what you want.
We have this message from John on Facebook. I have long thought this is the greatest strike against President Obama. Those of us in our 30s grew up watching The West Wing and suffering through the Bush years, really believed we were electing Bartlet in 08. I think that's one reason Obama was able to surpass Hillary. But as he chose to govern from the middle instead of the left, he began to disappoint those of us so enamored with him and his possibility. That's John on Facebook. And, you know, this could be another of the dangers, maybe, Dave, that you talked about, that we confuse real leaders and their flaws and compromises with fictional characters.
It probably can be. You know, I want to go back to your previous question about whether D.C. is a really great venue for these shows to talk about issues. Mm-hmm. And I think it is. But I think one of the big differences with the political shows we're talking about today is that they are very obvious when they discuss political issues. They talk about it in Washington as if they're going to make a policy change, and they usually try to discuss kind of both sides of the issue and who cares about different sides. But almost every TV show has a political element to it. We just usually don't notice it. One of my favorite examples is there was a big political flap over Duck Dynasty when the patriarch of Duck Dynasty gave a very controversial interview to, I think, GQ magazine, and people discussed, oh, wow, he shouldn't be talking about these policy issues. But, you know, Duck Dynasty, I admit I haven't actually seen it, but from what I hear, it's about this family that runs an ostensibly small business, and you see the daily functioning of a small business. Well, that's political. It is a somewhat scripted TV show that shows how small businesses function in America, and a lot of our policy is about how small business should function and how government should interfere with that functioning to achieve some kind of social goal. Well, that's political. I think every TV show out there has a political element to it. We're just not usually aware when we see them.
I would agree with that completely. I think we, encoded in any of our entertainment venues, I think are deeply held values about the political community. And, you know, they're successful precisely because they strike a chord with our collective conventional wisdom and what we value as a society. And that, you know, that's everything from Duck Dynasty to, you know, you look at something like Mad Men and you see an interpretation of how the women's movement progressed through the 60s, how the civil rights movement progressed throughout the 60s, how our corporate environments changed over time. And that's a mythology and a story, a narrative about who we are as a country today. And we're seeing it represented for us on screen.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to River to River on Iowa Public Radio. It's Politics Today, Politics Day today, and we're talking about politics on TV. And I want to get through some themes before the end of the hour. And one of the resounding themes in shows like House of Cards and Scandal, where actually in Scandal, the main character is having an affair with the president, is the amount of relationships and affairs going on in Washington in these shows. Here's a clip from season two of House of Cards, and spoiler alert, if you haven't seen the second season, you know, this is, or actually the end of the first season, this is after Vice President Frank Underwood murders Zoe Barnes, a reporter that he's been having an affair with throughout the first season.
Don't waste a breath mourning Miss Barnes. Every kitten grows up to be a cat. They seem so harmless at first, small, quiet, lapping up their saucer of milk. But once their claws get long enough, they draw blood, sometimes from the hand that feeds them. For those of us climbing to the top of the food chain, there can be no mercy. There is but one rule: hunt or be hunted.
So, with the amount of affairs happening in these shows, and, you know, sometimes in the news of real-life politicians, what does this say about the role of power in a politician's life?
Who's going to take that one?
I think this is one of the big unanswerable questions in politics. How much are our political leaders really corrupt and immoral? Even coming after, well, especially probably coming after the Clinton years, West Wing really avoided any kind of real scandal. The characters in West Wing, from my memory, are very clean. And nowadays, people don't seem to even want to see that. House of Cards is not clean.
Mm-hmm. No.
But it's one of those things that I think the public just has to kind of decide what they want to believe. I am sure, absolutely sure, that we have political leaders in Washington who are absolutely corrupt and immoral and probably are having affairs left and right. But there are also, I'm sure, lots of people in Washington who are very moral and are clean and avoid corruption and do the right thing. And we will never know which proportion is which. We have to just kind of decide to trust the process or not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think at this point, most people believe, I mean, if, you know, the opinion polls are any sort of accurate reflection, most people believe elected officials are crooked. So if they would have a show like The West Wing, now where everybody is clean, I'm not sure that that would really change anybody's opinion, because we've seen, you know, the approval of government, trust in government, go down at times in single digits. And so I'm not sure a single TV show showing a number of clean individuals like in The West Wing would really change any of that, change the perception that's out there.
No, and we, you know, earlier we talked about the fact that the West Wing had this kind of explanatory component to it. So you could take information away from The West Wing about the processes that are used, particularly in the executive branch, but also in the legislative branch. And I think what we're seeing now is, you know, because we don't have a lot of great places to get good information about the process of government, because we don't have a lot of opportunities to learn about why government, you know, policymaking takes so long and why compromise is built into the process, what we oftentimes get from our news media is we get snippets of scandal. And it attracts everybody's attention, and we can say, oh, woe is us. We have these these crooked people in Washington. But then, of course, you know, the next step is to build an entire TV show around Scandal. That's what happens, because that's what people know about right now. That's what people are paying attention to. And the first season of Scandal, you know, really, we had the fixer who, you know, when there was a political scandal, people came to her and said, hey, how do we manage this crisis in our personal lives or our political futures? And she was there to help navigate the political waters for them and with them. And that, again, is kind of a behind the scenes look at how image is managed, how ego is managed, how these crisis situations are dealt with by the people in power. And now, of course, Scandal really has gone over the edge. But
Well, and we have a show right now that is devoid of scandal, and it's called C-SPAN, but not
right.
Many people watch it.
Well, one of the things you said, Rachel, was about how in the news it's hard to see the process, and we always hear about scandals as they come out. And I think one of the changes that has happened in the last 5 years, really, is that we used to hear news come out about scandals of people in Washington, and that would be somewhat balanced by news about policy accomplishments.
Right.
And so you had the good and the bad. And then when there was a policy accomplishment, they would have a big celebration in the Rose Garden. The president would be there. They'd have leadership of the two parties, and they would talk about their great accomplishment. Well, we don't have any policy accomplishments anymore. So the only news we get is scandal and scandal. And that has to only darken the mood of the American public.
Well, and let me thank you all. You transitioned perfectly into talking about Veep, because in Veep, Vice President Selena Meyers is constantly getting into little, I wouldn't say they're even scandals, but, you know, little fibs that her team constantly has to clean up. In this next clip, Veep Selena Meyers informs her staff that she's accidentally made a conflicting promise on a bill that she's crafting to be a part of her legacy.
Hey, I think I did the right thing, but I just need you to confirm that I did the right thing. I said something to someone.
What exactly did you say, ma'am, and to who?
To whom?
Senator Doyle said that he would sponsor the bill.
Oh.
If we keep oil off of clean jobs. And there was an implication, perhaps,
You didn't say yes.
No, I didn't say yes. I said... Yeah.
Okay, well, we told Oil we put one of their guys on clean jobs. That's why we got away with the Cutler tweet.
I know.
Okay.
She's aware of that. I was charmed by Doyle. He's got that little twinkle in his eye. He just niced me. I got nice. All right? And where were you, Amy, by the way? Where were you?
No, you said you had it covered.
No, I didn't have it covered, and it's your job to know that if I say I have it covered, I don't have it covered, and you cover me. I need you all to make me have not said that. I need you to have make me unsaid it.
So I bet you've all known some political staffers. How accurate do you think this representation of their work is? How much of it is cleaning up messes?
I would say that is probably a large job of staffers. However, and I do like that clip because I think that explains a lot of the political process kind of in a funny way. However, I think the vice president there, it's a little unrealistic to think that anybody gets to that level of political office and doesn't understand the gamesmanship of politics. But it's kind of a lighthearted way to say, well, this is how politics works. If you want to get one bill done, you have to make promises, and those promises will limit your ability to get future bills done.
Mm-hmm. And another theme in Veep in particular is how social media and the 24-hour news cycle have changed the amount of time these campaigns and, you know, their staffers been protecting the politician's image. So let's listen to a clip in which White House aide Jonah informs the Vice President, Selena Meyers, that a photo of her checking her cell phone at an inopportune moment has become a meme.
Why are you even here?
Oh, I came here to tell you that you're a meme, ma'am.
I'm a meme, ma'am? What are you talking about? Speak English, boy.
A meme, an internet phenomenon.
Oh, okay. Yes, there are photoshopped versions of this springing up all over Twitter. You, the Declaration of Independence with Mary Magdalene at the crucifixion, 2004 tsunami.
Well, if there was a tsunami, you'd be genuinely looking at your phone because you'd be checking the weather.
You know what? I don't need you to talk. How do we stop this meme, ma'am, shit?
No, it's just a meme, ma'am, not a meme, ma'am. And usually they flame out after about 48 hours, but sometimes they blow up and become a super meme, like Downfall or Gangnam.
I love Gangnam.
What did I just say?
Yeah, if it gets on Reddit or Tumblr, that can happen.
Yeah, okay. You gotta get out of here, okay? Take all these meaningless syllables with you and just get out.
So what do you think we should consider here? You know, has politics changed for the better? Is this a good, you know, depiction of what it's like now to be a politician, that so much of your time is spent on your online image?
Yes.
Yeah, I don't think there's any question.
Yeah. Well, yeah, the staffers certainly seem, I haven't watched Veep, but they seem nicer than they are in House of Cards.
They do. They do.
So much nicer.
Yes.
I think now most political, political leaders, the higher-ups, they have to have a social media coordinator now who coordinates their entire internet presence, because it's so important now. And I think every politician has to have some kind of internet gaffe at some point. It's kind of like a rite of passage.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
I think one of the reasons that Veep is interesting, and I haven't watched as much Veep as regularly as I have the other shows, but I think one of the reasons that it's interesting is, in some senses, you feel like Selena is a much more sympathetic, real person. You know, she's caught up in a bunch of weird situations and doesn't always know how to deal with them. And of course, you know, Julia Louis-Dreyfus does a great job of kind of playing that frantic energy. And I think it brings a level of humanity to who these people are.
Do you think that in a different way than House of Cards, do you think that Veep showing how much time they are consumed with their image and that sort of thing, does that make the public weary and cynical in a different way? Is that?
No, I think it's the reality of it. I mean, if you talk to staffers or you visit with elected officials and you look at their daily schedules, I mean, it's all public and it's all out there and they have to be concerned with it. I mean, anybody even running for office anymore has a social media consultant or someone on their staff who is entirely devoted to social media. So I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing. I think the public at this point simply understands that it's a reality, because it's not just elected officials that get caught up in the social media trap. We see all sorts of celebrities and other people that get caught up in it as well.
Mm-hmm. So we have about a minute left, but I want to ask you all really quickly, is the backdrop of Washington, D.C. what the Wild West was for Westerns in the 1950s? Are we going to be seeing a lot more TV shows coming out of D.C.?
Well, we've had a record number in the past couple of years. I believe when I counted them all up, we had 11 in total that were introduced in some form or another over the past 2.5 years. Some of them have done well, some have failed, but it seems to be appealing to a wide swath of viewers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think the next one is just they're going to have to be to continue to be more extreme, which probably means less in touch with reality.
I can't wait to see that.
Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah.
Well, this has been a great hour. I want to thank my guests, Rachel Caulfield of Drake University. Thanks, Rachel.
Thank you.
Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa. Thanks, Chris.
Thank you.
And David Anderson at Iowa State University.
Thanks for having me on.
Thanks. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.